This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Where They Found Her by Kimberly McCrate. Performed by Tavia Gilbert, Lauren Fortgang, Rachel F. Hirsch, and Therese Plummer. One can't build little white picket fences to keep nightmares out. Anne Sexton. Prologue. It isn't until afterward that I think about the bag or the bloody towels stuffed inside. They're too big to bury, but I can't just leave them behind. Maybe I should have been better prepared, thought more about the details, but it's hard to be ready for something you'd never imagined you'd do. I end up taking them toward Route 17. A dumpster, I figure. Behind a gas station, maybe, or a fast food restaurant. And then, in the morning, a trash company will come and haul the evidence away. But the gas stations are all still open. So are the restaurants. Cars parked right near the garbage. Customers in and out. Too many witnesses. It isn't until I come to Highlights, the tanning salon, that I find what I'm looking for. It's closed and backs up to an empty lot, a dumpster tucked in a far, dark corner. My heart is pounding as I go to lift the lid. Relief. That's what I already feel. Almost over. Almost finished. The whole thing. But the top won't budge. I jerk it once, twice. The second time I do it so hard that I bend my fingernails back. It's chained shut. Locked tight, so someone like me can't hide dirty secrets inside. But I can't look for someplace else. I don't have time. Can't wait one more second. Can't take one more step. This needs to work. I need this to be over. Now. I race around the edges of the dumpster, yanking up, looking for a sliver of weakness. Finally, I find an edge that lifts just a few inches, but enough, maybe. I have to shove hard to get the blood-soaked towels in, even harder to push the canvas bag through the thin crack. I'm afraid for a second it'll get stuck. But when I push my whole weight against it, it flies through so fast that I almost smash my face against the edge of the dumpster. When I pull my hands out, they're covered in blood. For a second, I think it's mine, but it's not mine. It's the baby's blood. All over me again, just like it was an hour ago.
Molly Sanderson. Introductory session, February 18th, 2013. Audio transcription, session recorded with patient knowledge and consent. If you didn't want to come see me, I'm wondering why you're here. It's nothing personal. I didn't think it was. But even if it were, that would be okay too. Because everything's okay in therapy. You don't think much of the process. No, I'm sorry. I'm not usually this belligerent. I didn't... used to be, anyway. Grief can be a very powerful force. And so, this is the person I am now? This is who I'm left with? I don't know. Who are you now? I have another child, you know. A little girl. Ella, she's 3. Anyway, she's the real reason I came. For 2 weeks after it happened, I didn't even get out of bed. I don't think I touched Ella once that entire time. Didn't hug her. didn't tell her everything would be okay. I wasn't the only one who'd lost a baby. Ella lost the little sister she was so excited to meet. It was all she'd been talking about. Wait, I need a tissue. Sorry, just...
You don't have to apologize for being upset. You've experienced an incredible tragedy, Molly. Some would say losing a child is the single most traumatic experience a person can have.
Is that why I feel this way?
What way?
Like I died that day, too. And there's nothing that's going to bring me back.
Maybe we should start at the beginning. Molly, I think it's time you told me how you lost the baby. Molly. The sky through our large bay window was just beginning to brighten when I opened my eyes. Not quite morning. Not the alarm. Not yet. When the noise came again, I realized it was my phone vibrating on the nightstand. Eric Skenazy glowed on the screen in the darkness. "Is everything okay?" I answered without saying hello. In the 5 months I'd been working at the tiny but respectable Ridgedale Reader, the paper's contributing editor-in-chief had never once called me outside business hours. He'd had no reason to. As the Reader's arts, lifestyle, and human interest reporter, I covered stories that were hardly emergencies.
"Sorry to call so early."
Eric sounded tired or distracted, or something. I wondered for a second whether he'd been drinking. Eric was supposedly sober these days, but it was widely rumored that his drinking had gotten him fired from the Wall Street Journal. It was hard to imagine fastidious Eric, with his tall, rigid posture, swift military gait, and neat buzz cut ever being sloppy drunk. But there had to be a better explanation for a reporter of his caliber landing at the Reader, editor-in-chief or not, then his wife Nancy, a psychology professor at Ridgedale University, being tired of commuting to Ridgedale from New York City, where they'd lived when Eric was at the Journal. Not that I was one to judge. I'd gotten the staff position at the Reader thanks to Nancy being on the faculty welcoming committee. I didn't know how much Nancy had pressured Eric to hire me, or how desperate Justin had made my situation sound. But from the exceedingly kind, almost therapeutic way Nancy regarded me, I had my suspicions. And with only a law degree and a decade of legislative public policy experience for the National Advocates for Pregnant Women on my resume, I was fairly certain that I hadn't been the most qualified candidate for the staff reporter position. But Justin, now a tenured English professor thanks to Ridgedale University, had been right to do whatever it took to get me a fresh start. And writing for the Ridgedale Reader had given me unexpected purpose. I had only recently come to accept, after much grueling therapy, that the grief, flowing from me unchecked since the baby died, would continue until I forcibly turned off the spigot. "No, no, that's okay, Eric," I breathed, trying to get out of bed so I didn't wake Justin. "Can you just hold on 1 second?" It wasn't until I tried to move that I realized Ella was in our bed, her body latched onto mine like a barnacle. I had a vague recollection of it now, her standing next to the bed. A bad dream, probably. Ella always had the most vivid night terrors, often shrieking into the darkness while dead asleep. I'd been the same as a child, but I'd assumed it was a side effect of life with my mother. More likely, the terrors were genetic, the pediatrician told me. But I could handle them better than my own mother did. Earplugs, a lock on her door, her most angry shout. So Ella regularly ended the night tucked between us, something Justin had begun a gentle but concerted campaign to stop. "Okay, sorry. Go ahead, Eric," I said once I'd managed to twist myself out from beneath Ella and made my way into the hallway.
I was hoping you could help with something,
he began, his tone even more brusque than usual. Nancy was so warm by comparison. I often wondered how they'd ended up together.
I've had to leave town for a family emergency, and Elizabeth is on assignment in Trenton, and Richard is in the hospital, so that leaves... Is he okay?
I felt a knee-jerk wave of guilt. I hadn't wished an actual illness on Richard, but in my darker moments I'd come close. Elizabeth and Richard, both in their late 20s, covered the actual news for the reader, though they weren't trying to compete with the national dailies or the 24-hour online news cycle. Instead, the Ridgedale Reader prided itself on in-depth coverage with lots of local color. Occasionally, I got assignments from Eric, covering the new director of the university's prestigious Stanton Theater or the celebrated local spelling bee, but largely I pitched my own stories, such as my recent profile of community outreach tutoring, a program for local high school dropouts generously run by Ella's kindergarten teacher, Rhea. Elizabeth had been polite to me, at least, but Richard had made clear that he saw me as a washed-up mom unjustly handed a seat at the table. That his assessment was largely accurate did not make it more enjoyable.
Is who okay?
Eric sounded confused. You said Richard was in the hospital.
Oh, yeah, he's fine,
he scoffed.
Gallbladder operation. You'd think he was having open-heart surgery from the way he complained, but he should be back in 48 hours. In the meantime, I just got a call. Someone reported a body up by the Essex Bridge.
A body? It came out in a squeak I loathed myself for. You mean a dead body?
That would be the implication.
Eric sounded skeptical of me now. He probably had been from the get-go, but I wasn't helping matters.
I need someone to head out and see what's going on. And with Elizabeth at the governor's round table and Richard out of commission, I do it myself, but like I said, I have this family emergency. I'm not sure when I'll be back.
Is everything okay? With your family, I mean. Why was I getting personal? Eric hated personal. When we'd arrived in town back in August, I'd been sure that Eric and Nancy would be our first friends. Justin and I hadn't socialized in a long time, and we needed to. Justin already had the professorial connection with Nancy, and I'd been instantly drawn to her warmth, even if it was partly attributable to her view of me as a prospective patient. Eric was a little prickly, yes, but he was also incredibly bright and extremely interesting. However, Eric and Nancy had politely spurned all our advances, brunch, barbecues, concert tickets, all of which had been outside my comfort zone anyway. Perhaps it was Eric's checkered history, or Nancy's fertility problems, ones she talked about with an emotional frankness I envied, that kept them at a distance. Or maybe they just didn't like us. Regardless, it was as though Nancy and Eric were encased in very fine barbed wire, visible only upon close inspection. And my own skin was far too thin to risk pushing nearer.
Yes, we're fine, Eric said with typical curtness. Anyway, looks like you're on this dead body story for now, assuming you're up for it.
Of course, I'll head out right now, I said, relieved that I sounded so calm and efficient. But I was already nervous. To everyone's surprise, including my own, I'd done a pretty good job so far bringing my little corner of Ridgedale to life. Even Eric, once a prize-winning foreign affairs correspondent, had seemed impressed. But I'd never covered anything remotely like a dead body. In Ridgedale, those were a rarity. There hadn't been a single one since we'd lived there.
Good,
Eric said. There was still hesitation in his voice.
Have you, ever covered a crime scene?
He was being polite. He knew I hadn't. A crime scene? That seems to presuppose a murder. Do we know that?
I asked, pleased that I'd picked up on his jumping of the gun. Good point. I suppose we don't, Eric said. Our source in the department was vague. All the more reason to tread lightly. Despite what they seem to think, the local police aren't entitled to any sort of special treatment from us, but they'll already be on the defensive with the university to contend with.
The university?
The wooded area near the Essex Bridge is outside campus proper, but it's university property, Eric said. It's my understanding that it was a campus safety officer who called in the body. As you can imagine, the university will be motivated to keep this quiet. Assuming any of this information is even accurate, there's always the chance that we'll find out the whole thing is a false alarm.
The door creaked as Justin came out into the hallway, squinting his hazel eyes at me. His shaggy brown hair was sticking up in all directions like a little boy's. "Who's that?" he mouthed, pointing to the phone with a furrowed brow, as he crossed his arms over the Ridgedale University t-shirt hugging his triathlete's wiry frame. I held up a finger for him to wait. "Okay, I'll be careful." Now I sounded so effortlessly confident that I was almost convincing myself. "I'll text you an update once I've gotten down to the scene. I assume you'll want something abbreviated for online, full length for print tomorrow."
"Sounds good," Eric said, still hesitant.
He was doing his best to buy into my confidence, but he wasn't all the way there.
"Okay, then. Good luck. Call me if you need anything."
"Eric?" Justin asked sleepily after I'd hung up. He scrubbed a hand over his beard, which, despite early resistance, I now felt weirdly attached to. It covered up much of Justin's angular features, yet it managed to make him look even more handsome.
"What did he want in the middle of the night?"
I looked down at my phone. It was a little past 6 a.m. "It's not the middle of the night anymore," I said, as though that were the relevant point. My voice sounded spacey and odd.
"Hey, what's wrong?"
Justin pushed off the door frame and put a concerned hand on my arm. Because I wasn't allowed to be spacey, not even for a second. Not anymore. That's what happens when you dove off the deep end. People got alarmed when you dared poke a toe back in the murky waters. "Nothing's wrong. Eric just wants me to go out to the Essex Bridge for a story," I said. "They found a... someone reported a body."
"Jesus, a body? Really? That's terrible. Do they know what happened?"
"That's what I'm supposed to find out. Apparently, I'm the temporary substitute features reporter for the Ridgedale Reader."
"You? Really?"
I watched Justin realize he'd stuck his foot in his mouth.
"I mean, great, I guess. That seems weird to say if someone's dead."
The bedroom door opened wider behind us, and Ella padded out in her red and white striped pajamas, brown curls twisting out in every direction like a bouquet of springs. She was squinting exactly the way Justin had, with her matching hazel eyes. Apart from her hair, which was a chocolate-hued replica of my own reddish curls, Ella was a miniature version of Justin. From her oversized eyes and full ruddy lips to the way she smiled with her whole face, Ella was living proof of the power of genetics. "Sorry, sweetheart. I didn't mean to wake you." I reached down and hoisted a heavier-than-ever Ella up on my hip. "Let me put you back to bed."
"I don't want to go to bed."
Ella pouted into my neck.
"I want to be ready."
"Ready?" I laughed, rubbing a hand over her back as I carried her down the hall toward her room. "Ready for what, Peanut?"
"For the show, Mommy."
Shit, the show. A kindergarten reenactment of the Very Hungry Caterpillar, in which Ella was to be that crucial one green leaf. The show was at 11 a.m. There was no telling if I'd make it. "You'll be too tired for the show if you stay up, Peanut. It's way too early," I said, pushing her door open with my foot. You'll need more sleep or you'll forget all your lines. Ella's eyes were already half closed by the time I was tucking her back under her pink and white checked duvet and her massive, colorful menagerie of stuffed animals. Reading to Ella in that bed had always made me feel like the little girl I'd never been. And on a good day, it could almost convince me that I was the mother I'd always hoped I'd be.
"Mommy,"
Ella said as she snuggled up against her huge red frog. "What, sweetheart?" I smiled hard, trying not to think about how crushed she'd be when she realized that I wouldn't make her show.
"I love you, Mommy."
"I love you too, Peanut." Now that I was finally back, not perfect, not by a long shot, but much, much better, I did everything I could to avoid disappointing her. I was about to say something else, to apologize for missing her show, to make promises or offer bribes, but it was already too late to plead for forgiveness. Ella was fast asleep. Justin was back in bed by the time I returned to our bedroom. I could tell he was not yet asleep, despite his best efforts. "Ella's show is at 11 today. It won't take long, 15 minutes maybe. Tape it for me, okay?" I headed for my bureau. Nice but practical, that was what I needed to wear. Or maybe professional but unafraid to tramp through the woods was closer to the mark. Yes, that was it. Intrepid. I didn't get a chance to warn her I was going to miss it. You don't think I should wake her up to tell her, do you? I hate to think of her being surprised that way. I could feel Justin watching me move around the room getting dressed. I pulled on my nicest sweater, the pale blue cashmere that Justin's mother had bought me, that set off my eyes, then tugged on a pair of my best non-mom jeans.
"I have to teach at 10, babe," Justin said.
When I turned, he was propped up on an elbow.
"I can take Ella to school, but I can't do the performance. I'm sorry, Molly, but you know how the university president has been about professors missing class lately. He's on a personal crusade."
"One of us has to be there, Justin," I said with irrational force. I knew he couldn't miss a class unless there was a true emergency, and despite how I was feeling, a kindergarten performance didn't qualify. "I'll have to stay at the bridge until I have what I need for the story, assuming I can figure out what that is. This may be an all-day thing."
"I agree completely," Justin said. "You need to go out there and report on this story to the best of your ability. This could be a real opportunity, Molly, and you need to seriously nail it. My guess is, Eric's not big on second chances. Today, you chasing this story is more important than even the very hungry caterpillar."
Because for me, this wasn't just a story, of course. Everything I did these days was another plank in the bridge to a better me. I had become what I once would have despised, the living embodiment of a self-help book. And what about Ella? I felt panicky. I couldn't help it. Letting her down again, letting her down again. It was playing on a loop in my head.
"Come on, she'll survive."
Justin laughed, but not unkindly.
"No offense, but this isn't her Broadway debut. And how many shows have you been to this year? 10?
I shrugged. "I haven't been counting." Justin pushed himself up in bed and swung his feet to the floor.
"You know as well as I do that we're not doing Ella any favors by giving her the impression that love means never being disappointed."
"I think she's already been disappointed plenty, don't you?"
"Come on, Molly."
Justin stood and beckoned me into a hug. I shuffled over and wrapped my arms around his strong upper back. As he squeezed me tight, he smelled like the menthol he'd been massaging nightly into a torn right hamstring as he lamented the indignities of aging.
"You're a good mom," he whispered into my ear. "You don't have to keep trying to prove it."
But Justin,
with his doting parents and idyllic childhood, could afford to live in a world of value judgments and calculated risks. It had been part of what attracted me to him. But it wasn't easy to be someone's mother when you'd never really had one of your own. Even before I was depressed, I'd always relied on a single, surefire parenting strategy, trying to be perfect. "Okay, fine," I said, because Justin was right. I knew that intellectually, even if I didn't feel it. "But you'll explain it to Ella when she wakes up, right? Why I can't be there? You'll prepare her that neither of us will be?"
"I'm on it, I promise," Justin said, kissing me. "Now go kick some writerly ass."
It was barely light, the world a muted gray as I drove through the center of Ridgedale. Around the manicured green downtown, the trendy boutiques and expensive coffee shops were locked and dark. The sidewalks were empty, too, apart from an old man walking a tall, spotted dog, and two women in fluorescent tops and coordinating sneakers, jogging and chatting. To the right was the wide stretch of ivy-covered campus behind a tall iron fence, the sky burning orange at the horizon. It was all so beautiful in the half-light. It was hard to believe how much I'd resisted moving to town when Justin, whose specialty was 19th and 20th century American literature, first mentioned the professorship at Ridgedale University. 25 miles north and a little west of New York City, Ridgedale was a place we probably never would have considered living, had it not been for the university. I'd been afraid that leaving the city would make me feel even more isolated and lonely. Not that Ridgedale was some remote farming village. There was a Michelin-starred farm-to-table restaurant and a dozen good ethnic ones, not to mention the world-class Stanton Theater, an excellent university hospital, and two independent bookstores. The people in town were an eclectic mix, too, with students and faculty from around the world. Things hadn't always been so sophisticated, or so I had been told. The Bristol-Myers executive offices, relocated from downtown Manhattan to right outside Ridgedale 3 years earlier, had notably increased the percentage of the town's wealthy liberals. Some long-standing Ridgedale residents, in general less affluent and more conservative, were still bristling at the proliferation of soy lattes and Pilates studios. They longed for the good old days when the university students could shop only at the campus store or Ramsay's pharmacy, and when the dining options in Ridgedale were limited to pizza, chicken wings, or all-night pancakes at Pat's. It was a conflict that often played out in the spirited comments section of the newspaper's online edition. These battles might have little to do with the article they were appended to, but nonetheless, they routinely mutated into personal attacks on reporters. At least according to Elizabeth, who had cautioned me never to read the comments on any of my articles posted online, even those that seemed innocuous. It was the one piece of advice she'd given me, and I had listened. I might have been ready to try my hand at this journalism thing, but I wasn't steady enough to weather being assaulted for it. I made a left and a quick right, heading past all that majestic stone on the leafy western edge of Ridgedale University. From there, it was a quick shot to the Essex Bridge, which was far enough away that I was surprised it was university property. When I came around the last bend, the sky had gone from gray to pale blue, the sun hidden behind the high hills in the distance. Even in the dimness, the patrol cars up ahead were impossible to miss. Three were sticking out into the road, and a fourth was parked up against the trees, as if it had rolled to a stop there on its own. I had been preparing myself to arrive and find nothing, for it to have been a false alarm, as Eric had warned. But there were the police, and here was the bridge. And down below was Cedar Creek, and, apparently, a body. There wasn't a person in sight when I got out of the car, just the flashing of the blue and red lights between all those leafless trees. It was quiet, too, the only sound my feet on the pavement. It wasn't until I'd walked up to the car at the front of the line
that I heard some voices floating up from the woods. I paused, noticing for the first time that my fists were clenched. Tread lightly, like Eric had said, that was all I had to do. And yet that had seemed so much easier to execute before I'd gotten out of the car. "Hello, I'm Molly Sanderson from the Ridgedale Reader. Would someone maybe have a minute to answer a couple questions?"
No, much too tentative. Not being obnoxiously overbearing made sense. Presenting my answers as though they were optional? Decidedly ill-advised. I didn't need to be a seasoned reporter to know that.
"Hello, I'm Molly Sanderson of the Ridgedale Reader. I'd like to verify some facts." Much better. A little pushy, but not appalling. It was also accurate. I did have the fact of a body I wanted to confirm. Fact, plural, was a bit of an overstatement, but I knew from being a lawyer that feigning a position of strength could be a prerequisite to success. When I'd inched up close enough to see the water, I could tell right away what all those nervous weathermen had been worried about when they'd talked about late winter snow followed by early March rain. Flash flooding wasn't something you really considered in New York City. They mentioned it, but big, dirty puddles were usually how it manifested. As I looked at the creek, though, more like a river as it bounced dark and fast over stones and swept up broken branches, the potential for destruction was clear. Already a big chunk of the near bank was gone, caved in like the ragged edge of a cliff. On the far side of the rushing water were half a dozen uniforms near the water's edge. A handful of others fanned out in the woods beyond, searching for something, though their procedure didn't seem particularly methodical. They were crisscrossing back and forth, kicking at leaves, poking with sticks, half seeming like they were merely pretending to be doing something useful. There was something blue on the far bank, too, a plastic tarp cordoned off with yellow police tape. My breath caught. All that nervous energy sucked into the ether. Because there it was, down in those wet, rotting leaves, between all those skinny, leafless trees. The body. Somebody's dead body.
"If you ask me, they should flip the switch when they find the bastard," came a voice next to me. "And I don't even believe in the death penalty."
When I turned, I saw a young guy in a snug, bright yellow fleece and fitted black shorts. He had a radio strapped around his chest and a campus safety officer emblem on his shoulder. He smoothed a gloved hand over his fluffy blonde hair and rested it on the back of his neck. He should have been good-looking. He had all the makings of it. Cute face, muscular body. But he looked like an oversized child, as if he had gotten larger without actually maturing. It wasn't the least bit appealing. "What happened?" I asked, opting not to identify myself, which probably violated all sorts of reporterly ethics. But then I wasn't technically interviewing him. He was the one who'd started talking to me. He looked me up and down, eyes lingering on the expensive, brand-new sorrel hiking boots I was wearing. A gift from Justin meant to get me excited for our new life in the country. They presented an inaccurate, outdoorsy picture of me, but one that might be helpful in context. Finally, the man looked back up, his eyes narrowed.
"Who are you?"
"Molly Sanderson." I held out a hand. He hesitated before shaking it, squinted eyes locked on mine. "And you are?"
"Deckler," he said with annoying brevity. "You're not with the Ridgedale police. I've never seen you."
"I'm a writer." It was more neutral than reporter. "Someone from the police department contacted us." Shit. Why had I said that? Eric's contact was surely not public knowledge. It was probably the only thing more important than treading lightly, not exposing my boss's critical, confidential relationships.
"Someone from the police department contacted you? To come here?"
"Us," I should have said. "I don't personally know the details," I said, hoping he'd drop it. "You found the body?" Deckler held up a hand and shook his head.
"Don't think so," he said.
You want an official comment? You'll have to talk to Steve.
And Steve is...
down there?
Declar nodded toward the water. Standing in the middle of the creek in thigh-high rubber fishing pants was a huge man in a sharply pressed shirt. He had his muscular arms crossed, strong square jaw set as he stared upstream, glaring at the current as if willing a suspect to float down his way.
It's in his hands now.
His hands? I asked.
Ridgedale Chief of Police, Declar said,
but with an edge, like he didn't think much of him.
Campus safety's here for support.
They just come in and take over? That had been his implication, and there was no telling what might pop out if I stirred the pot. His jaw tightened.
Only on something like this.
He exhaled in a puff of disgust.
Most campus crime stays on campus. There's a whole disciplinary process with hearings, evidence, all that. We handle it all ourselves, confidentially. You know, to protect the students.
To protect the students, right, I said, trying not to sound snide. Because all I could think was, or protect the perpetrators. But not with something like this. He shook his head and looked back out over the water.
No, I guess not.
And what is this, exactly? Declar shook his head and huffed again, seeming insulted that I'd asked the same question twice.
Like I said, you want details? You'll have to talk to Steve.
Okay. I smiled as I took a step toward the creek, already imagining myself at the edge, waving like an idiot to get Steve's attention. Even from this distance, he did not look like he'd appreciate that kind of thing.
Whoa, hold up.
Declar barked before he'd gotten very far.
You can't just go down there. I'll have to call him up.
Oh, no, that's... Before I could get my objection out, Declar had whistled loudly through his fingers right next to my ear, as if calling a dog. When Steve swiveled his head in our direction, he did not look happy. Really, I can wait, I offered meekly, though it was already too late.
Not here next to me, you can't.
Steve looked even more aggravated as he stalked to the side of the river. Don't you think we've got more important things to do than waste our time talking to reporters? I could already imagine him saying that as I watched him take the time to climb out of the water, put on his police hat, which he'd left on the bank for safekeeping, and start up the hill. It took an excruciatingly long time for Steve to climb in those boots that should have looked ridiculous on him but somehow didn't. It helped that he moved with a slow, strong surety, like he already knew how things were going to turn out. At the top of the hill, Steve nodded briskly in my direction before turning to Declar. He was better looking up close, the lines of his strong face offset enough to make his square features interesting instead of odd. Nothing like Justin's fine bone structure, of course. Justin was the kind of man... women openly ogled. Steve was the kind they counted on for a rescue.
There a problem, Officer Declar? This is Molly Sanderson.
Declar sounded pleased to be ratting me out.
She's a writer. Someone from your department told her to come here.
I'm with the Ridgedale Reader. I reached out a hand and smiled at Steve, hoping we could breeze past the whole issue of who had called me. I don't want to take up your time. I'd just like to confirm some facts. I motioned toward the tarp. You found a body. Steve shook my hand slowly, eyes boring into me.
The Reader, huh? Are you new? I know that other fella. Robert, is it?
Richard, I said, feeling stupidly satisfied that he'd gotten Richard's name wrong.
Someone from my department called you.
I don't know the details. My boss told me to come down here. Actually, I'm just pinch-hitting. My usual beat is art. Little Lost Girl seemed as good a way to play it as any, especially when it didn't feel that far from the truth. And from the way Steve's face immediately softened, I could tell it had been the right call. I really do apologize for intruding. You have a job to do, I understand that. But if you wouldn't mind helping me do mine, then I can get right out of your way. Steve stared at me for what felt like an inordinately long time. I had to strain not to look away.
"Because you're here, and you're local, I'll tell you what I can," he said at last, crossing his arms. "Shoot."
It took me a beat too long to realize that he was waiting for an actual question. "Have you identified the victim?" I asked, hustling to maintain my composure as my heart beat harder. But I could do this. I'd practiced the whole ride over. And being a reporter wasn't that different from being a lawyer. Not that, as a policy analyst, I had done a lot of interrogating. I hadn't really questioned anyone since mock trial in law school.
"No," Steve said, shaking his head as he turned to look at the water.
Okay, not as wordy a response as I had hoped, but that was okay. I had other questions. "Any leads on who it might be?"
"No."
"Male or female?"
"Female."
I felt a little thrill, an actual answer. A female victim. It wasn't much, but it was something. I was getting worried I'd have absolutely nothing when I went back to Eric. "Approximate age?"
"I wouldn't want to guess."
Steve's eyes were back on mine, but softer now. Sad, almost.
"We'll need confirmation from the medical examiner."
I could feel Deckler staring at the two of us. Judging was what it felt like.
"You're not falling for his macho crap, are you?" "Two more questions," Steve said. "Then you're going to need to clear the scene so we can get our job done."
"Did she die of natural causes?"
"Unclear," he said.
"Unclear?" I couldn't let him get away with that. "No indication?"
"Nothing I'm going to comment on without an official ME report."
Just then, the radio on Steve's hip buzzed life.
"They're going to need a smaller bag down here," a crackly voice said. "You know, baby size. Adult ones won't work. Emmy wants us to go pick one up."
Steve snapped the radio off his waist, his jaw tightening. His eyes were locked on the creek as he brought the radio to his mouth.
"Then send someone," he answered through clenched teeth. "Now."
He switched the radio off entirely before sliding it back into his belt. He hadn't looked back at me, and I was glad because the air felt thin as I wrapped my arms around myself. A baby? A dead baby? I was afraid I might be sick, right there on the chief of police's tall rubber boots. I thought about Ella. How hot and alive she'd been, wriggling against me when they'd laid her on my chest that first time. How surprised I'd been that my body had actually worked, that she'd made it out in one pink wailing piece. I thought, too, of the next time, when my body hadn't worked the way it was supposed to. When I'd gone to the doctor for my routine 36-week checkup, and she couldn't find a heartbeat. And the trauma of the agonizing labor and delivery that had followed. For a baby everyone already knew was dead. Everyone, that is, except me. I alone held out hope that my second daughter would gasp and cough her way to life once she was free of me. She did not. There had been only that awful clinical silence afterward, metal against metal, rubber gloves snatched off. And how she'd felt in my arms, like she'd been emptied out and restuffed with wet tissue and sand. No, I should not be letting myself do this. Think of it, of her. I would not. I closed my eyes and shook my head. I was not in that delivery room. That was almost 2 years ago. Right now, I was there on the side of that creek with a job to do. And I needed to do it, as if my life depended on it. "It's a baby," I managed. It was a statement, not a question. Steve was staring in silence down the hill, his face an unreadable mask.
"Listen, I understand,"
he said with genuine, unexpected kindness. When he turned to look at me, his face was so sincere that I thought I might burst into tears and throw myself against his huge chest.
You're just trying to do your job.
I am doing my job, I said, trying to remind myself. That's exactly right. But all I wanted to do was go back to my car and pretend this whole thing had never happened. That Eric had never called me, that I'd never taken the job at the Ridgedale Reader, that we'd never moved to town. I wanted to return home, crawl into bed, and pull the covers up over my head. I might have, too, if I hadn't known that this time there was no way I'd ever climb back out.
I've got a deal for you, Steve said. You run some kind of basic alert right now online. Body found, details pending. Hell, I don't even care if you say it was on university property. Hey, I don't think that's a good...
Deckler fell silent when Steve shot him a look.
You're here as a courtesy, remember? Steve said.
Deckler pressed his lips together like a huge toddler trying not to scream. I was surprised he didn't stomp one big black sneakered foot. Steve went on.
You'll still have a big jump on the story. But I've got to ask that you keep that last detail confidential.
As though the victim being an infant were a detail at all, like eye color or hair length?
It could compromise the investigation if you make it public now. And I'd like a chance to get our sea legs here before the word gets out. Not long, just a few hours. You do that, and I'll give you an exclusive interview.
Okay, I heard myself say. Steve checked his watch.
How about you meet me back at the station at 10 a.m.?
I wanted to say no thanks or never mind, but that baby out there wasn't my baby. My baby was safe and sound at school, and she needed me to keep it the hell together. She needed me to keep on moving on. Something about turning away from this story, of all stories, felt perilous. As if, unbeknownst to me, I'd be letting go of the one thing holding my head above water. Sure, I somehow managed. Sounds good. I'll see you then. But already I regretted every word.
Sandy. Sandy wasn't asleep. But she wished she was, lying there on the stumpy living room love seat, eyes closed, especially when there was a knock on the front door. It wasn't a regular, hey, anybody there? Knock, either. It was one seriously pissed off bang, bang, bang. Sandy had learned to tell the difference without asking who was doing the knocking. Motherfuckers looking for money would never leave once they knew you were home. Instead, they'd sit on your place all day and night, making a shitload of noise. That was their whole job, to make your neighbors hate you. Like that could make someone without money suddenly come up with some. Open the door, Jenna, came a man's voice outside. Sandy rolled over to face the front door, but she didn't get up. She wasn't scared he would kick it in or anything. They never went that far. He could have, though, no problem. Their front door was basically bullshit cardboard. Ridgedale Commons was the cheapest, shittiest place in all of Ridgedale, tucked way the hell in a corner of town, and the only two blocks of nasty for miles around. When they'd moved in 8 months earlier, the apartment hadn't looked half bad, especially compared to some of the places they'd lived. But as it turned out, the okay part of Ridgedale Commons was paper-ass thin. The place fell to shit overnight. Come on, Jenna! Came the voice again. Closer this time, sounding like his sweaty face, their faces were always sweaty, was pressed against the door. I know you're in there! Now, that right there? Total load of shit. There was no fucking way he, whoever he was, could know that. Sandy didn't even know that. She never knew for sure when she woke up whether Jenna would be home. Most of the time she was, but Sandy had learned a long time ago to sleep through whatever noises came in the middle of the night. She lifted her eyes toward Jenna's bedroom door. Shut. Which must mean Jenna was home, but not alone. Otherwise, She'd be sprawled out naked on top of her covers with her door open wide. She got lonely when she couldn't see Sandy out there on the couch. If it had been up to Jenna, she probably would have left the door open even when she had company. But the men she brought home sure as hell wanted privacy. And thank God, because there were lots of things Sandy wanted to see in this world. The sun setting over the Pacific, the Grand Canyon, the Great Barrier Reef. But Jenna going at it with some liquored-up scumbag wasn't one of them. She'd already seen enough of that to last a lifetime. Sandy pushed herself up off the couch, wincing. Her arm had scabbed over. Now it looked even more disgusting and hurt like a son of a bitch whenever she flexed it hard. Her knee was a crazy shade of purple, too. Hard to forget something when your fucking body kept sending you news flashes. But she would, eventually. She'd have to. And Sandy was good at forgetting things. She'd have lots of practice. Sandy pulled her sleeve down over the huge scab, then grabbed a cigarette out of the pack Jenna had left on the coffee table. Sandy wasn't a huge smoker, wasn't even sure she liked it. But there were times that called for a cigarette. Like now. She put a Parliament in her lips and lit it with the jewel-encrusted I Love Tampa lighter Jenna must have swiped off of somebody. Sandy took a drag, glancing down at her see-through tank and low-rise sweatpants. The thorn stem of a rose tattoo wrapped around her arm, the flower tucked safely behind her shoulder blade. She twisted her long, straight black hair into a knot at the back of her neck, then exhaled a long stream of smoke. There were worse things than this asshole being able to see through her shirt. A free peek might be her best chance to get rid of him. Ever since Sandy had gotten tits, they'd been the main thing she had going for her. "Hold on," she shouted, so he wouldn't yell again. "I'm coming." This asshole making noise was the kind of thing that Mrs. Wilson, their 80-year-old neighbor, would get all bent out of shape about. Mrs. Wilson was a complaint-making machine, everything and everyone, like it was her fucking profession. But she hated Jenna and Sandy extra. Her face puckered every time Sandy ran into her, like she'd sucked on a rotten lemon. Mrs. Wilson wanted them out of the building. That was the bottom line. If they gave her an actual reason, she might just get her way. Sandy took the three short steps to the door, then put her hand on the knob. She took one last drag before swinging open the door and exhaling into the air. "Jesus, take it easy," she said, calm and cool, chin tilted up as the last of the smoke escaped her lips. "I'm here, okay?" The sun was barely up, the sky a suck-ass gray. It was earlier than Sandy had thought. Chance for this mess to pass, and for the rest of the day not to be a total shit show. Maybe. Sandy lowered her eyes to the man outside her door. He was skinny and short and weaselly, with some gross strands of hair combed over the top of his head. Disgusting. Guys like him always were.
"You're Jenna Mendelsohn?"
He squinted skeptically at his clipboard.
"Who's asking?"
Sandy took another drag and leaned against the door. No need to give up the full frontal view of the ladies just yet. They might come in handy later.
"Well, Miss Mendelsohn, you're 3 months behind on your rent."
He ripped a notice off the top of his pad like a parking ticket and handed it to her. 3 months? That shouldn't be. They shouldn't be a single month late. But with the tutoring and everything lately, Sandy hadn't had time to get the money order herself, like she usually did. Who knew what the hell Jenna had done with the cash? Drunk it, smoked it, given it away? Sandy could be so fucking stupid sometimes. Why the hell had she taken Jenna's word for it? She should have made sure the money had ended up where it was supposed to go. Then again, considering everything, maybe it was a good time for them to be getting the hell out of Ridgedale. Not that Jenna would be easy to convince.
About a year ago, she mentioned running into some guy from Ridgedale she used to know on the street in Philly. Then she'd acted like it was all a big coincidence that they'd ended up back there. But Sandy wasn't an idiot. Biggest surprise was how long it had taken once they'd moved to town for Jenna to tell Sandy the whole ugly story. Sandy would have sworn she knew every last one of Jenna's awful secrets, but there had been more. And knowing what had happened to Jenna in Ridgedale all those years ago didn't change how messed up she was. But it changed the way Sandy saw her. Made ditching Jenna, even now when she probably should have, a total fucking impossibility. "We're not late," Sandy said. She'd been down this road before. Even if this guy was right, denial might buy them some time. "We're totally paid up."
"You've got proof you've paid?"
the greasy guy asked. Sandy curled her body around the door so he could get a good view of her see-through top. She pulled her upper arms together as she leaned forward a little, pressing her tits together. "You could say that I had proof," she said, rolling her eyes up his pant leg. "Just for a couple days. Give us some time, you know?" The guy looked Sandy up and down, his eyes lingering on her breasts. Then he snorted and shook his head like Sandy was a disgusting piece of shit.
"You've got 24 hours, miss," he said. "After that, the place'll get locked up. If I was you," he looked at her boobs one last time, "I get packing."
Sandy took the wrinkled yellow ticket out of the asshole's hand, then watched him strut his stubby legs down the walkway and disappear. "Notice of pending eviction," it read across the top. God damn, Jenna. Yeah, it was time to go. But did it have to be with a fucking gun to their heads? Thank God Sandy kept an emergency stash, $1,000 she'd saved up, in a box behind the couch. It wasn't enough for 3 months' rent, but it would hold them over for a few days someplace new. Somewhere far the fuck away from this place and all its bad goddamn memories. Sandy stormed back toward Jenna's bedroom, the eviction notice crumpled in her fist.
"Jenna!"
she screamed at the door so loud it burned her throat.
"Wake the fuck up!"
When there was no answer, Sandy kicked the door. It flew open, Sandy bracing herself for the sight of some naked, hairy ass diving for cover. But there was nothing. And no one. Jenna wasn't there. And from the looks of it, she hadn't been all night.
"Fuck,"
Sandy said quietly, her anger tightening into a ball at the bottom of her stomach. Where the hell was Jenna? Sandy went over to check her phone for a text, something like, "Going to crash here, see you in the morning." But there was nothing. Not a goddamn thing. So much for that civics and econ homework Sandy was supposed to finish for Rhea and the algebra quiz she had to study for. Not that she should have been surprised. Going for her GED had been a stupid goddamn long shot. It was the kind of thing that other people did. But then Sandy had let herself get sucked in by Rhea, found herself thinking, why not me? Jenna, that's why fucking not. What a joke.
"Where the hell are you?"
Sandy texted Jenna.
"Listen, Sandy, no one's perfect," Rhea had said at the end of that first meeting they'd had back in October, almost 6 months earlier. The sweet way she'd been smiling at Sandy had made her throat tighten up. "And anyone who pretends they're perfect is a liar." It had taken a lot for Sandy to drag her ass into Ridgedale High School to the community outreach tutoring office. She hadn't been in a school since the spring before, when she'd finished up her sophomore year at that hellhole in Northeast Philly. She hadn't even considered starting at Ridgedale High School when they'd moved there in September. Food, rent, coffee, all of it was a lot more expensive in Ridgedale. Sandy would have to work more to carry her own weight. But then,
goddamn Maria had come into Winchester's pub for lunch when Sandy was working. And she had that nice smile and those kind eyes. And she'd asked Sandy all these questions. Caught off guard, Sandy hadn't had her usual lies at the ready. And so,